Well, thank you, Lee, and thank you to CEDA for the opportunity to speak at this session today. It's a real pleasure to be here and a very warm welcome to all of you. I'd like to start by acknowledging representatives of the diplomatic corps, in particular the Consul Generals of Japan, the British Consul General, the Consul General from New Zealand, and the Consul General from the Netherlands, and thank them for their extraordinary contributions in supporting their country's engagement with Australia. I'd also like to acknowledge three people in particular in this room. I'd like to acknowledge Neville Roach, I'd like to acknowledge my former colleague Doug Ferguson, and the Honourable Warwick Smith, all three of whom have done an extraordinary job in supporting Australia's engagement with our major trading partners. And it's a great privilege for us at Asia Link to build on their great efforts. So thank you all for your efforts. So in my presentation today, what I'd very much like to do is first and foremost highlight how global growth forecasts continue to show that the Asia-Pacific region, which is where the majority of our trading partners reside, will continue to be the region which will be the fastest growing region in the world. And then highlight what I think is extraordinarily important to understand in Australia, the political economy in each of our major trading partners, because of the impact that domestic policy issues can have on foreign policy interests. I'd then like to briefly speak about international trade performance at a global level in 2018 and the impacts of the US-China trade war, in particular some recent research which highlights the diversion to third countries or the spillover effects from the trade war. And then finally, I'd like to speak about the trade outlook for Australia in 2019, but really focusing in on one particular point, which is our willingness to invest in Asia and to stop this process of decoupling trade from investment. We cannot reach our full potential if we are not willing to invest, engage, have boots on the ground in Asia. So as we look at the IMF's global growth forecast, we start to see that across the world, whereas the US, UK, Euro region, Japan, Australia, and you look at the performance of the Asia-Pacific region, you see that Asia and emerging Asia will continue to be the fastest growing region in the world. The global economy is forecast to grow at about 3.5% in 2019, which is down from the 3.7% that was achieved in 2018. And one of the reasons for the downward forecast in 2019 is because of the US-China trade war, a potential no-deal Brexit, concerns about the performance of the Chinese economy, concerns about the economies in Italy and in Turkey, and also some concerns at an industry level, for instance, concerns about automotive sales in Europe as a result of introduction of new fuel emission standards and what that might do for automobile sales, particularly in Europe. So a range of reasons at a geopolitical level, at a specific country level, and at a specific sector level are impacting global growth forecasts in 2019. But it's pleasing to see that the region in which 7 out of our top 10 trading partners will continue to be the fastest growing region in the world, and we're uniquely positioned to continue to capture opportunities with them. China grew at 6.7% in 2018, and there's a great degree of concern about the performance of the Chinese economy. But we do need to understand it's 6.7% on a $14.5 trillion economy. It's not close to double-digit growth as it was 10 years ago, but 10 years ago it was 9.5% on a $4.5 trillion economy. So we need to be a little bit measured with some of these concerns raised when looking at headline growth rates. Some of the key issues that the Chinese government is facing at the moment in its domestic economy is related to excess industrial capacity, excess real estate stocks, and of course dealing with the leverage ratio of its firms and also at a local government level. When you look at the recent performance within the Chinese economy, you see that the total profits of above-scale industrial firms is at its lowest level in 3 years. The Purchasing Managers Index for the manufacturing sector is also at its lowest level in 3 years. So there are some really significant structural issues that the Chinese government needs to focus on in 2019. And this is in addition, of course, to the US-China trade war. Prime Minister Abe was elected for a historic third term in 2018, and should he see his current 3-year term through to 2021, he will be the longest-serving prime minister in Japan's history. In 2019, Prime Minister Abe is very focused on seeing through a consumption tax hike from 8% to 10%. And at a personal level, he is committed if he can garner the support to see through a reform of their constitution, in particular Article 9, which will restore Japan to its post-World War II state as a normal state and give it the right to determine when it can use its own special defense forces. And finally, one of the big issues that Prime Minister Abe is focused on is obviously the aging population. The impact of that on the workforce is that there have been significant construction delays in major projects in Japan, impacting the ability to deliver on the 2020 Tokyo Olympics. And so one of the most important outcomes that Prime Minister Abe delivered on in 2018 was to get a foreign workers and refugee bill through Parliament, which will now allow 345,000 foreign workers to work in Japan over the next 5 years. The impact of concerns of the Trump administration, common concerns, I should say, that both Japan and China have held, have seen actually a normalization rather than a reconciliation between those two countries, with Japan coming forward and endorsing China's Belt and Road Initiative. Prime Minister Modi in India is gearing up for a general election in April, May of this year. Unlike his win in 2014 in a landslide election, it is likely that in 2019 he will have extraordinarily strong competition because his power base has been eroded. He has lost 5 major elections in the states over the last couple of months. There's been a lot of talk about the high-quality economic policymaking of the Modi government in its first term. However, there is a question mark whether this economic policymaking has ultimately delivered jobless growth, because unemployment in India is at a 45-year high now at 6.1%. It's never been that high. It hasn't been that high, I should say, since 1972. And that will be, in my opinion, perhaps the number one issue that Prime Minister Modi will have to address as he goes to the general election. President Moon in South Korea has seen growth of 2.7% in the South Korean economy, down from 3% the year before. And a big focus of his government is actually driving labor market reform. There was increase in the minimum wage rate in South Korea from $5.8 to $6.7, which was the largest hike since the year 2000. They also sought to limit the maximum hours that could be worked in a working week from 68 to 52 hours, which includes additional time and overtime. The net impact of that was actually not positive, because businesses, in particular small businesses, chose to just hire fewer people. And so unemployment actually grew. So in addition to continuing efforts to reconcile with North Korea and the opportunity to do business with North Korea and source potentially low-cost labor, labor market reform within the South Korean economy is shaping as one of the most important focus areas for President Moon and his government. President Widodo is also gearing up for a general election on the 17th of April. 12 months ago, when there were 170 regional and sub-regional elections to go in Indonesia, it seemed almost unthinkable that President Widodo would be really challenged. But 12 months on, with 2 months to go to a general election on the 17th of April, Prabowo, who he's competing against, is looking stronger and stronger. It is still likely that President Widodo will win the election, but when you look at the state of the Indonesian economy with the depreciation in the Indonesian rupiah, and you look at the balance of payments crisis that they're starting to have, and you look at Prabowo's vision for a more self-sufficient economy, which is really catering to the populist sentiment in the Indonesian citizenry, we can see that that election could be a lot closer than we expected perhaps 12 months ago. So it's really important to recognize some of these significant domestic policy issues and tensions that our major trading partners are facing, because it does have a cascading impact on the way in which they engage at an international level. Because we all know that there are no votes in foreign affairs. So in 2018, the Asia-Pacific region continued to dominate global trade, accounting for about 38.5% of global merchandise trade. It also saw the largest growth or increase in commercial services, dominated by growth and delivery of services, in particular out of China and India. And the Asia-Pacific region showed that it was the most important, not just source of FDI in the world, but also the recipient of FDI in the world. But what's concerning is the growth of protectionism, not just at a global scale, but also in Asia. Across the countries of Asia, there were on average 33 new protectionist measures introduced every month, which was more than double the number of liberalizing measures introduced. So this trend of protectionism is very much in our neighborhood as well. The trade war, as you're all familiar with, has seen $250 billion worth of Chinese goods affected by U.S. tariffs and $110 billion worth of U.S. goods affected by Chinese tariffs. And of course, we're in the midst of a truce at this moment up to the 1st of March. I've been following the impacts of this trade war now over the last 12 months, and I've read a number of exceptional reports by the banks and consulting firms. And until late last year, actually, I was following very closely a three-part scenario planning exercise being undertaken by KPMG's economics team, which was an outstanding piece of work, which highlighted the impacts of a potential contagion on the global economy, including on Australia. However, last month, in the lead-up to the World Economic Forum in Davos, UNCTAD did some extraordinary work to actually highlight what might be the trade diversion outcomes to countries around the world if this trade war were to continue. And what UNCTAD highlighted was that of the $250 billion of Chinese exports subject to U.S. tariffs, it is likely that 82% of those sales will actually be diverted to third countries. Only 12% will be retained by Chinese firms, and 6% will be transferred to U.S. firms. And of the $110 billion of U.S. exports subject to Chinese tariffs, or tariffs from China, only 10% will be retained by U.S. firms, 5% transferred to Chinese firms, and 85% diverted to third country firms. So what this means is that a two-way trade war is really strong at having an impact on rival firms, but not necessarily supporting domestic firms, which is one of the core objectives of the trade war in the first instance. Because you're seeing here between 82 to 85% actually being substituted for by third countries. And one of the top three countries that is expected to be a beneficiary is Australia. It's forecast to be a beneficiary to the tune of almost 4.6% to the total value of its exports. So I thought this was quite useful analysis because it gives us a sense of the substitution effect of many of the products that are the subject of the trade war so that we don't think of the trade war purely as a zero-sum game. Australia and what lies ahead for us. I do want to challenge the assumption that we are a trading nation. If you look at our trade to GDP ratio and our level of openness, it's comparable to that of India, which has only been open for the last 28 years. It's comparable to that of Indonesia's and China's. And when you look at it relative to other advanced developed countries, we don't seem to be as open. When you look at the composition of what we trade, it hasn't changed very much over the last 10 years. Mining and resources and energy, agricultural products and services and two main categories of international education and tourism still dominate our basket of commodities and services traded. Nothing wrong with that. But when you look at the value that we add to what it is we trade, we were ranked 195th in the world for the simplicity of the basket of what we trade. So if we want to transition to a more services-led engagement, more value-added engagement, given that 3/4 of our economic performance and 9 out of 10 jobs are in the services sector, then we're going to have to see quite a significant shift in the way in which we do business with our major trading partners. We've concluded a number of very significant free trade agreements, as many of you will be aware. The trifecta in particular was an extraordinary outcome for Australia and Australian exporters. Last year, we signed the CPTPP, and later this year, we might also be able to sign the RCEP. But the question remains, have these FTAs actually been adopted by business? Extensive research by The Economist, by HSBC, and a number of consulting firms have highlighted extraordinarily low adoption rates of these FTAs, and particularly low adoption rates in Australia. More recent research by PwC has highlighted that internationally engaged firms, so those firms who are already engaged in international markets, are actually adopting and using our FTA network a lot more than those that are not engaged at all. But one of the core purposes of concluding many of our FTAs was to attract those businesses that weren't already thinking about doing business internationally to start to consider doing business internationally. And that is still very much a work in progress. In addition to tariff barriers, we have seen, as I mentioned, growth in protectionist measures, particularly at the border and behind the border. Of course, it's been in the news in the last day of delays in customs of Australian coal that's being imported into China. There are reports that one port in China has banned Australian coal. And there are reports that other ports are delaying Australian coal up to 45 days. We've heard similar reports, of course, going back last year to customs delays in the wine industry. And this is not unique to our relationship only with China. We've seen this with other countries as well, where the free trade agreement has accorded us extraordinary benefits to export, but we've had at the border and behind the border issues. So as we think about our narrative and the future for Australian engagement with the region, that future very much lies in the services economy. As I highlighted, 3/4 of our economic performance is accounted for by services, yet services accounts for only approximately about 20% of our trade. And so the opportunity for financial services, not just our banks and insurance companies, but in particular our funds management sector, in particular our superannuation funds and the fund managers, and the opportunities to invest in Asia, healthcare companies, infrastructure, engineering and construction companies, professional services firms, and even the creative industries, the opportunities are extraordinary in Asia. But one of the things with services trade, unlike trade in bulk commodities, is that you have to be close to the end customer. We're very good at trading from afar. But when it comes to investing and being close to the end customer on the ground in an Asian market, we're not that willing to actually invest. We invest more in New Zealand than all 10 countries that make up ASEAN. We invest the same amount in China as we do in PNG, notwithstanding that we have $190 billion worth of two-way trade. I think it's about $90 billion of which is just iron ore. When it comes to actually investing, we're not very keen to do so, and we also don't have a great history when we have done so. And one of the reasons for that is because irrespective of tariff and non-tariff barriers, we always have to focus on the level of awareness, the level of knowledge, and the capabilities of the workforce to design, to develop, and to execute international strategies. Research that we undertook approximately 15 months ago, which looked at the capabilities of our ASX 200 board members and senior executives, we tested for 6 very specific capabilities, which we found had a strong correlation with doing business successfully with Asia. And we found that 67% of ASX 200 board members had no experience of operating in Asia. 55% of ASX 200 board members had no real knowledge of Asian markets. On a score out of 30, board members across the ASX 200, this is the entire population of 1,223 board members, got a score of 6.42 out of 30. And senior executives fared even worse at 3.79 out of 30. So knowledge and capabilities are at the core of being able to invest successfully in the region. I thought I'd use a case study, and I'm so glad Neville mentioned our engagement with India that the Honorable Chris Bowen also spoke about. And he spoke about Peter Varghese's report that Prime Minister Morrison endorsed at the end of last year, which sets an economic engagement agenda with India, which is to triple our current exports to India from $15 billion to $45 billion, and to grow our outbound investment from $10 billion to $100 billion. This is the first and only engagement strategy that I know of an Australian government, which has bipartisan political support, I should highlight, which is fantastic and needed because this is a 20-year strategy to 2035, that has an outbound investment target. Historically, we've focused on trade and inbound investment. But the opportunity with India will be a consumption-led opportunity in that market's consuming classes. We cannot decouple bulk commodity trade with services and investment. And so in order to achieve this target of $100 billion, It's only possible if many of our large listed companies and super funds and fund managers actually have a strategy to invest and do business in India. And so I wanted to dispel some of the myths about doing business in India. There is a view that I hear of regularly, including from several chairs earlier this week, you simply can't be profitable in India. Who's profitable in India? Well, when you look at the Nifty index versus the ASX 200 across verticals such as consumer healthcare, consumer staples, healthcare, utilities, telecom, energy, revenue growth is significantly greater than ASX 200 companies. EPS growth of the Nifty index companies will be 20% this year compared to 5% growth in the ASX 200. The Nifty index is up 77% over the last 5 years. The ASX 200 is up 7% in that time. Of course you can be extraordinarily profitable, and we have US companies and European companies that are extraordinarily profitable in India. We also now have some Australian companies that are very successful in India. There's a terrific case study in the strategy of BlueScope Steel, which had plenty of options to exit its joint venture with Tata Steel in India. But their board had the courage to stay their course. And after 7 years, they broke even, and now it's one of their fastest growing investments in the world. Let me ask all of you, if someone told you at the start of an investment cycle that in 7 years' time you could break even, and then it could be one of your best performing investments, would you take it in Australia? Probably would. So when we think of some of these international markets such as India, it's important to recognize that 7 to 10 years is actually not a very long time. So the right mindset is obviously exceptionally critical to succeeding in Asia, and I thought I'd show you some results from the most recent reporting season. There is no burning platform, of course, in Australia. A near-record number of 93% of ASX 200 companies reported a profit and 90% paid out dividends. Exceptional results. These are the best results since the GFC. So it's absolutely outstanding, and we should all be really proud of the performance of our top 200 listed companies. But I also want to point out that Australian companies with significant offshore earnings have outperformed the market by 37%. So why can't we do well in our domestic market and also do well in offshore markets, given we have lots of examples, including from this week, of A2 Milk due to its exposure to the Chinese market and its outstanding distribution strategy had seen itself catapult to a $10 billion enterprise, going beyond organizations such as Coca-Cola. Really significant brands, because it's got access to the scale of a major economy. So what are the pathways at a practical level? And I've touched on some of these, but I might just touch on a couple more here. Recruiting Asia-capable talent. We receive significant feedback from Australian expatriates who worked for not just Australian companies in Asia, but for US companies and European companies, that when they return back to Australia, they're asked to actually play down their Asia experience. Nobody wants to know. That's what they're told. They're told by recruitment firms, nobody wants to know. We've never received a brief from a nominations committee asking us to find Asia experienced talent. Huge issue. How are we going to leverage the diaspora across Australia? We heard about that earlier today from the Honorable Chris Bowen, a huge source of not just talent for our workforce, but to build relationships and partnerships on the ground with many of these countries. And the final point that I want to make is that having a cultural diversity plan is important. And of course, I'd be delighted if there was one across most enterprises, because someone like me will benefit. But can I just say, being Asian identifying does not make you an expert on anything about Asia. It really doesn't, right? So I had to leave India, and it was only after studying India for 20 years from afar that I actually learned a little bit about India. Who thinks deeply about their country when they live in it? Who does? You just live and breathe, what it is you actually experience on a daily basis. But my point here being that if you think of some of our best executives who have led the Asian agenda for their organizations, like Mike Smith with 29 years experience out of HSBC, every day of the week, Mike, as a as a Scot will be more Asia capable than me. There's no doubt about it. He's had far more experience than me. So our narrative has to be a narrative for the entire workforce. Addressing cultural diversity is one part of it, but the aim has to be for the entire workforce to become more aware, more knowledgeable, and more confident to engage in international markets. And I want to leave you with some real hope, because while we have a lot of work to do with our large listed companies in Australia, and I completely understand, please don't think that I don't understand their short-term performance pressures and the pressures they're under from hedge funds and from activist investors. I do understand, and I'm hugely empathetic. And at the end of the day, as I showed you, their results, they've just had an extraordinary year. So congratulations to them. I just want to see them do even better for Australia. That's where I'm coming from. But I also have the privilege with my team of working right across this country. We're responsible for the national workforce from Huendon in Queensland to Wagga Wagga to the Pilbara to Warrnambool. We're working with local and regional councils and businesses. We're working with all 40 universities in relation to the new Colombo plan in providing pre-departure training and in supporting alumni of the program. And there's tremendous dynamism in our universities, in our SMEs, and government at all levels. And interestingly, they're actually leading this country in many ways, with large listed companies following. And so on that note, I might close my presentation there, but really just highlight that awareness, knowledge, and capability building are the key to creating an Asia-capable workforce. Thank you for listening.